The following is paid for by the Coalition for a Better Hollywood. For decades, Big Movie has had Hollywood studios in their back pocket. They spend millions to get you to spend billions on movies that are nothing more than sequels, reboots, remakes, reimaginings, Oscar cliche and January releases. Big movie lobbyists have all but ensured original film ideas are ignored, forgotten, or maybe not even real. Are they feature films? Are they quality flicks? Are they real motion pictures? Your soon-to-be, if not already favorite movie podcast stands with the little movies. Help put an end to Big Movie's cinematic censorship and listen to the pop-up film cast every Tuesday wherever honest hard-working podcasts can be found. We are the Pop-Up Film Cast, a proud member of the Podfix Network, and we support this message.
Dear listeners, it seems you've stumbled upon this recording despite all our best efforts to keep it hidden from the world. The following is a review of a dark and dreary tale, one you are better off not hearing. If you value your happiness, I urge you to pause this episode, power down whatever device you found it on, and find a much happier review to grace your ears with. You have been warned.
Hello and welcome to The Picture Show with Austin and Phil Rude. I am Phil Rude. I'm the dad.
And I'm Austin Rude. I'm the son. Each week we watch a movie and then we get on mic and we talk about it.
Indeed we do.
That's right.
That might be our best intro ever.
I remembered my lines.
All right. Up top, yeah.
All right. Never again.
Yep. And then we stepped all over it, patting ourselves on the back.
As we do.
Yep. How you doing?
I'm good.
Yeah?
Yep.
What are you up to this week? You got all this time off now?
I know. I feel like
chilling.
Feel like content-wise I should be watching more, but I don't think I have been.
That's not necessarily a bad thing that you're not just melting away in front of the TV all summer.
No, I need to rot my brain while I still can.
You need to really waste your time now that you have it to waste.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's a good motto to live by.
Sure.
I have been, House, the Sherlock medical show, right? They upload like 10-minute clips of episodes on YouTube. They have pretty much like the whole show just like in clips.
Okay.
Pretty much. I don't know, but it's really addicting, and sometimes I get stuck in a loop of like watching, because it's not like just 10 minutes directly, like the beginning or something. It's like they take the plot line of an episode and they kind of just condense it to this one medical case.
So you can kind of just watch an episode of House in 10 minutes.
Yeah. And there's people in the comments who are like, I've never seen a single episode of the show, but I love it. And so, I don't know, it's weird, but I got sucked into that recently.
I feel like House is one of those shows that, especially if you condense it down like that, you would watch a bunch of 10-minute videos that would all be essentially the same. Like, House is, like, so formulaic that it just is, like, the little bit that I saw, I think every episode was the same. And I'm not even, like, digging on that because, like, Columbo and all these other, like, procedural detective shows were all the same too.
Yeah, it's definitely a procedural. I can never say that word.
I know, it's a weird word.
But like, I love the character of House.
Right.
Like,
yeah. That's why you do it. Yeah.
Exactly. And like, there's drama between the characters and that changes throughout the episodes.
Right.
So you can kind of get like a whole season's plot point from watching like 10 videos or something. And it's, you don't have to sit through like, I don't know, what is it, 10 hours of television for, because it's whatever, like 20 it episodes each season. It's like, it's made to fill air.
Yeah, it's content. Yeah, I mean, in the purest sense of the word content, it is just like, we have space to fill, let's just make something to fill it with.
I kind of like that TV shows have diverged from like, it used to be the norm for like 40-minute episodes and like 20 episodes, 25 season.
Episodes. Yeah.
Now it's like 10, which I feel like that cuts out a lot of the dead weight.
Yeah, I think it takes a lot of the filler out, and in general, you're getting like 10 good episodes.
Yeah.
You know, like, as opposed to like 25 good enough episodes or whatever it is. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah.
With House, though, they have like certain episodes that are more like this is about dealing with chronic pain, like House, like emotionally. Mm-hmm. And this is dealing with like religion and like kind of like debates like that. I find those episodes where it kind of breaks the format a little bit, like, more interesting.
Okay. Yeah, I didn't watch enough of House to get into all that, but back in the day, I did watch NYPD Blue when that was like a brand new show.
Is that like a precursor to NCIS?
It was more of a drama than a procedural, but like every week there was like a case.
Okay.
And the case always went, that was like the B plot always. So like the case always kind of went the same, but it was really about the drama of the characters and what they had going on. Like there was always like two cops that were hooking up, or two cops that weren't getting along, or, you know, for whatever reason. And they dealt with things like within work, there was stuff about race and there was stuff about addiction and all this other stuff. And then just relationship stuff. It was a character drama, but there was like a procedural element to it. But that was always like in the background, and it was always exactly the same.
That's kind of the best way to do a show like that.
Yeah, no, it was a really good show for a few years. I watched kind of these middle years from like Jimmy Smits through like the end of like Rick Schroeder's. Like they had all like these revolving like...
It's like a rotating cast?
Part of them. Part of them were like the core people, and then like the main guy, like his partner switched out like 3 times.
Oh, okay.
So I went through like 2 of those, but no, it was a good show, and I get the procedural element of that. So
yeah, it's fun and it's bingeable.
Yeah.
What have you been up to?
Not too much since last time. I watched a movie the other day that I had been meaning to watch for a long time, and I just saw it on, I think it's on Hulu right now. And I just had a couple hours to kill, so I watched The Nice Guys from, like, 3, 4 years ago. It's Ryan Gosling and Russell Crowe are, like, private detectives in the 70s. And they're working a case. It is a comedy, kind of buddy cop, action-ish movie.
I forgot I was going to say Die Hard, but that's not the Kevin Hart one.
No, it's not comedy. It's not like Kevin Hart comedy. It's more like a Lethal Weapon or something like that, where it's like, it is a about detective solving a crime, but there's like also like hilarious shit happening. Not slapsticky, but it's just like, it's just a funny... So kind of like, buddy cop movie.
Okay.
Shane Black wrote it and directed it. And if you don't know Shane Black, he wrote Lethal Weapon. He wrote The Long Kiss Goodnight. I think he punched up the script for Predator, the original Predator. And he's actually in Predator as one of the commandos.
Oh, that's interesting.
And then he made the last Predator movie. Predators or whatever it was from a couple years ago. I didn't watch it. But he did a movie with Robert Downey Jr. called Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, which is very similar to this. It's a comedy crime mystery.
Yeah, that one I've heard about. The others I have no idea. But
yeah, it basically, if you've seen a kind of buddy cop action movie and some part of it takes place at Christmas, it's probably a Shane Black script. Iron Man 3. He wrote Iron Man 3.
Oh, hey. I mean, that's not the best light to put him in.
It's
not a bad
movie. It is definitely a tone that he hits. And everything... What's the other one? I think he wrote The Last Boy Scout. I don't... Shane Black is he's a prolific, like, action screenwriter and has been for, like, 30 years. And I really, really enjoyed The Nice Guys. I think it's really funny. Whenever you get two actors who aren't known for comedy, who can still manage to deliver the comedy and be really funny and kind of be straight men through the whole process, it's really good. Russell Crowe and Ryan Gosling are both really, really funny, and you wouldn't think that they would be.
Bring it on the show then, because now you're pitching it to me and it sounds interesting.
I will maybe bring this on the show, but I will definitely at some point bring Kiss Kiss Bang Bang on here. I think that movie is really good, and also I have not seen it for a while and want to see it. And anytime I can promote Robert Downey Jr. in a non-Iron Man role, so people can remember, like, Robert Downey Jr. is really, like, a capable, good actor at doing more than being just Tony Stark or whatever.
No, he's just one character,
when
Dad.
I almost called him Tony Stark. When you see Robert Downey Jr., like, really being something different, he's kind of a hustler in Kiss Kiss Bang Bang. And it's really just a kind of a, it's not terribly different personality-wise, but it is a different angle on it. And I think Robert Downey Jr. is great.
Was this pre-MCU?
I think it was kind of in the middle of MCU, because it was like, that was part of his big comeback, was doing Iron Man. Kind of solidified him. And then he did a bunch of stuff kind of in the middle of that first part of his run in the MCU. He did, like, Charlie Bartlett and I'm blanking now, but he had, like, a handful of movies where he was really, like, playing different kinds of roles, and he really kind of had a big comeback, and studios were willing to cast him again because he'd kind of shown, like, I'm a bankable star and I'm not on drugs anymore and I'm dependable and make you money, and I'm still good. And it really was, like, a big deal.
That's sad that I've never heard of most of those movies. Because I kind of thought, like, he had just been in the MCU for so long, and then, like, that weird, what was that animal movie? Like, Dr. Dolittle, or...
Oh, yeah. I forgot he did that.
Whatever that was. Yeah, like, I thought that was, like, his first big... Like, yeah, he breakout
did a,
role.
He
of
did a
that
bunch of, like, smaller movies. Okay. A lot of, like, independent stuff. And but yeah, we'll watch Kiss Kiss Bang Bang. If not for the show, we'll just turn it on some Sunday afternoon.
No, and, we don't watch anything unless it's for
only,
the show anymore.
Only for the show, that's right. It does feel that way sometimes. But yeah, I think that's about it. I don't think I've really taking time to watch anything that wasn't for the show, or I was still watching Sweet Tooth.
Okay.
And
have you finished it, or?
No, I'm about halfway through. I'm taking my time with it and kind of just enjoying it as it comes, as opposed to just inhaling the whole thing. So, yeah, that's it.
That's good.
But aside from that, we had a movie that you brought to the table this week.
That is correct.
What do we got?
This week, we watched the 2004 adaption of Lemony Snicket's A Series of Unfortunate Events, a story in which Snicket catalogs and retells the tragic events that befall three brilliant orphans, Violet, Klaus, and Sonny Baudelaire, as the devilishly handsome and great Count Olaf chases after them and their enormous fortune. This movie stars Jim Carrey, Emily Browning, Leah McKen, Kara and Shelby Hoffman, as well as Jude Law, Catherine O'Hara, and Meryl Streep. The movie was written by Robert Gordon, overseen by book author Daniel Hadler, and directed by Brad Silberling. And what surprised me was this movie won an Oscar, and I didn't know that.
You've got it right here for makeup.
That's right.
I think
yeah.
that's super deserving. This movie, Jim Carrey looks great in this movie.
He doesn't look like Jim Carrey.
As does Meryl Streep and Billy Connolly is the other guy, the uncle that they first go to live with.
Right. Dr. Montgomery.
Montgomery. Montgomery, yes. Billy Connolly's an Irish comedian and actor. And I love when he shows up in things. I think he's like a super charming guy. But like I don't know if this falls under makeup, but like they have these really distinct and like precise like haircuts. You know what I mean? Like it's everything is combed in this really like it's not elaborate like the Hunger Games, but it is like very precise.
And it's slightly cartoonish, yes, in a way.
Especially Meryl Streep's is like it's all swept one way and then swept another way over the top of her head, but it doesn't look ridiculous. It looks very intentional and very much like they're going for something over the top, but it still sort of fits the character and the look of this movie. It all like
right.
Yeah, I think that's a well-deserved Oscar.
It is. But it's something like no one ever talks about this movie getting an Oscar. So I never realized.
Well, I mean, like, didn't Suicide Squad win for like makeup as well? I mean, it's a technical award and nobody really gives props as far as Oscars when they're talking about like Oscar clout, you know, for technical stuff, sound design and wardrobe and things like that.
Yeah, everyone talks about best picture.
Right, best picture, best directing, best screenplay, actor, actress. But really, like, you know, this, a lot of these movies that maybe, and I'm not talking about this one, I think a lot of movies that aren't great movies, but look good, deserve credit for what they do right. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, if you're a standout in one of these technical categories, I mean, the look of this movie helps sell it, I think.
That's kind of what those categories are there for. Like,
for sure.
Maybe you made a horrible movie, but the sound
but
is
it looks
amazing.
Great.
Yeah.
or like this. I think Jim Carrey's makeup is incredible.
In which role? Because, I mean, he's just such a chameleon with all his disguises in this movie.
Well, in some ways, he kind of is. I mean, it's very clearly Jim Carrey or Count Olaf, but also, like, they kind of... It's like he's wearing the Count Olaf mask, and then they put another mask. Like, they do makeup over top of that.
They're really good at portraying him as a bad actor, but not bad enough to where it's like, come on.
And that's the thing is, like, you have to be a good actor to play a bad actor this well. Mm-hmm. It's a weird thing.
I noticed in parts of this movie, like, his accent kind of slips, because he does accents for all of the characters.
Right.
And, like, but it's intentional slips. It's not like Jim Carrey is messing up.
Count Olaf is messing up.
That's right.
Well,
it's hard to know where to start with this.
I assume you like this movie.
I have a tattoo based on this movie.
So
right. Yeah. I have Count Olaf's eye tattoo on my ankle.
Yeah, the eye tattoo.
Yeah.
But aside from, I mean, is that because of this movie or is that because of the books? Is it because of the Neil Patrick Harris series, or is it just in general you're a fan of this property?
I'm kind of just a fan of the whole thing, but it definitely started with the books. And this came out, like, as the books were coming out. Like, the series was not finished publication at the time that this movie came out. So, like, I kind of watched this movie, like, I don't know, at some point while I was reading the series. And so it definitely, like, I picture the characters in the book as the actors in this movie.
Right.
Yeah, it's hard for me to distinguish. And, like, I get some of the scenes confused. Like, I expect book scenes to be in the movie mm-hmm. and movie scenes to be in the book. And it's kind of a mess. But, yeah, this movie is definitely, I think it's a good introduction to a series of unfortunate events as a franchise.
Okay.
Yeah, I would say, because this is the first of two adaptions. They were going to adapt all of the books in movie format, but I don't think this movie got the critical reception that they were planning.
Yeah, I think a lot of people don't like this movie, right?
A lot of book fans don't like this
movie. That's what I was going to ask. Is this, you know, it's interesting that you watched this as you were reading the books and you still like this, because I feel like that's what a lot of the... Because I don't think this is a bad movie. I don't think... it's got some problems. But, like, I don't understand, like, the hate this movie gets. Because I'm like, this is a perfectly serviceable story. Like,
it, right.
It all connects. It's told sort of in sections. So I can see where they were pulling from different books, and they probably condensed a lot of stuff. But, like, as a standalone movie, as someone who's never read the books, I don't have attachment to this property at all, I think this movie is perfectly fine.
Book fans will be book fans.
Yeah, for sure.
And they will be mad that their favorite scene was cut, or that this character's appearance changed. A lot of the book fans much more prefer the Netflix adaption, which is a 3-season show where they do, each book is divided into 2 episodes. So they really like, they have room to flesh out these books, which are really only like...
How many books are there?
There's 13 books.
Holy shit. I had no idea. I thought it was only like a few books.
No, it's 13. Because that's an unlucky number.
I get it.
And they're all pretty much the same interchangeable plot, but with like the details right. and like, and it gets more mature as you go. But they're roughly like 120 pages. They're not long books. They're meant for children right. to read. But
books meant to be read, you say?
I know, it's shocking.
Weird. Very strange.
But whereas the show does a better job of like recounting the details of the book, I feel like this does a much better job of setting the mood that the book set, where it's like kind of gothic and grim.
Yeah.
But it's got like hopeful uptones to it. And like just the grimy like set of Count Olaf's mansion, and
not just all Count of this Olaf's stuff. Mansion, like everything is a little bit dark. It's a little bit foggy in every setting they go to.
Yeah, it's like an industrial revolution.
It's like a weird, like this movie seems to take place in Britain, but they all drive on the right side of the road and on the left side of the car. It seems to be Victorian, but they have cars and phones and trains. And Klaus dresses like a, you know, anytime kid, a 20th century kid. You know what I mean? Like,
but Violet is in like these elaborate
right.
goth
She's
dresses.
Wearing kind of goth. And Count Olaf is dressed very theatrically. You know, he has robes and big overcoats and
right.
Almost a steampunk look to him. There's a weird mixing of style here that makes you go, I don't know when or where this story is taking place. But that's cool, because I think the look of this movie is like, we're our own world. We're our own setting. We don't need to fit into any one time period or place.
Yeah, because that would kind of be limiting. I know the books do that as well, whereas like there's movie theaters, but there's also plays, and there's
right.
cars, but there's also horse and buggies. Like, it's yeah. all over the place. But it adds to like this strange world that they're in.
And it works. I think just like the, we talked about the makeup, I think the design, like the set design of this and the like the green screen backgrounds they use. They're all kind of washed out and gray, green looking a lot of the time, grimy looking. And that helps, I think, blend that green screen or any CGI they're doing, like, because there's kind of a haze over everything.
Yeah, I don't really notice the green screen, but I know it's there.
Like, that's what I'm saying. It looks better than it should because they sort of just put this haze over everything that blends it all better. But also, like, just the actual designs of the sets. You know, like you said, Count Olaf's mansion. That looks amazing. It's so cool looking.
It is.
It's just this run-down castle. And there's like no right angles. Everything is sort of warped and weird looking.
It's like, shot in like a claustrophobic kind of way.
Right, right. Everything's kind of closing in on all the walls kind of close in on you. And I don't know how they did it. I don't know if they built that whole set. I don't know if there's like forced perspective kind of things, but it all looks really incredible.
Yeah, the budget for this movie, I don't remember the exact number, but when I was looking at the details, it shocked me. And I think that's probably partly the big names, but like there's a lot of sets in this. There's a lot of detail work and stuff. So it wouldn't surprise me that they put a lot of money into set building as well.
Yeah. You said it though, like big names. We talk about that cast, like, you know, that's a lot of budget right there to get Jim Carrey at this time. I mean, that's a lot.
It's the height of Jim Carrey.
Meryl Streep, Jude Law, who I didn't even realize was Lemony Snicket.
Neither did I. Until they use his face.
Yeah, he's in shadows the whole time.
There's also, who's Beatrice in, the Harry Potter franchise?
Helena Bonham Carter?
Yeah.
From Fight Club?
Yes, she is an uncredited role playing the mother in this, only in shadow.
Really?
But apparently she was in this movie. Yeah.
Well, she's that silhouette then, that Violet finds the picture.
In the picture frame, silhouettes. Yeah. But then there's also a flashback to Sunny as a baby, yeah. And they have her in shadow there.
They have them both in there, and I don't know if I imagined this or this was some sort of Rorschach thing, but like, in that, they're almost the two silhouettes, and then there's like the shadow of the baby.
Yeah.
And it almost looks like a skull. And I'm like, is that some sort of weird foreshadowing, or is that just the way, is that my mind filling that in?
I've never seen that.
It's subtle, and I will be the first, if you tell me like, oh yeah, if you saw that, that was not intended, I'd be like, oh yeah, that makes total sense, but...
But I mean, with as grim as this story is...
This is a dark story, though. Yeah.
Which is weird, because it's aimed at children. Like this story is kind of just like, hey kids, the world is dark and screwed up.
Yeah.
But it's not necessarily a downer. It's hard to describe.
It is. It's dark without being devoid of hope. Because the children never stop trying to figure out a way to save themselves, to get out, to get away from Count Olaf, to try to alert, you know, the people they're staying with, like, no, this is Count Olaf, like, all the, and they're never just like, oh, it's hopeless, we may as well go live with Olaf. You only see that at the very end when she's being forced to marry him.
Right, and that's after, like, so long of just running around
right.
and being chased.
But even then, like, Klaus isn't giving up. Like,
right.
he's still working at it. So, yeah, it's a dark movie, but like you and I talked about the other day, like, kids can handle some pretty dark-sided stuff.
Like, yeah.
It's surprising, but, I mean, you were a kid when this came out, and, you know, you're not too screwed up.
Well, I mean, not because of this movie. But like that in that conversation, we were talking about Coraline and how that's just like there's horror in that, like horror aspects. Right. Whereas this, like the moral of the story is much more like dark. Like it's pretty much telling, like almost teaching kids how to deal with grief and loss and bad things happening to you. Like, and I feel like that's a message that's almost never taught to kids.
Like the message that shit happens and you have to keep marching on. Is that the message to take from this movie? Or just that, cause you say it's like that screwed up stuff happens. Is that, do you think that's the long and short of what this movie's trying to say?
I think, like, it's more like you can't change what happened. Like, they can't bring their parents back.
Right.
But they can find sanctuary in themselves. Like, that scene where they set up the little tent in Count Olaf's house. Like, they find their own bits of happiness throughout this movie. Even as, like, these guardians are dying and all of this tragic stuff is happening. So it's kind of like you can't. Like, shit happens, but don't just accept it. Kind of find a way to make happiness in the sad parts of life.
Depend on yourself and your circle to pull you through it.
Yeah, I think that's a good...
That's
a good way to say that.
Surprising. You and I have had... if this goes too personal, we'll cut it. You and I have had a bunch of discussions about, like, just bigotry and things in the modern age, and talking about, like, you know, is it worth beating your head against a wall arguing with bigoted people online? And my point of view tends to be, everybody has to, you know, have their come to Jesus moment on their own. You can't force somebody to become more enlightened. You can kind of show them the path, and then it's up to them to do that. And a lot of the, I feel like I'm getting off track here already. A lot of the argument against that is kind of a, but those people will think less of these people. And it's like, well, you have to just let... My argument is that you just kind of have to let people think less of you and not let that affect... You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
It's just sort of like, I mean, you're gay. There are people who don't like gay people. Do you let that change who you are, or let that stop you from living a full life?
I get what you're saying there. Like,
it's about, I'm kind trying of to tie it same... into like finding sanctuary. I should probably cut this. This doesn't make any sense in the context of this movie.
It does make sense. It's like
finding sanctuary in yourself is a valuable thing to do.
Like, you can either argue with homophobic people all day until you're red in the face, or you can just like
go marry a woman like they want you to do, and then they can accept you. Finally.
That's right. That's why he married Violet at the end of this movie. Everyone knows actors are gay.
Con Olaf does kind of give off some gay vibes.
He's kind of queer-coded. But, no, you're right in that, like, just cut the people who are going to harm you out of your life and find happiness in the people that you enjoy being with.
Right. That's what I was trying to say. Why didn't you say that in the beginning instead of letting me ramble on for
'cause the
minutes?
Movie said it for us.
Because the movie... Right, that's what I was trying to equate it to. The idea of finding sanctuary. And that's actually, like, it took me a lifetime to come to that conclusion on my own.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of interesting to see a message like that now that you pointed it out and go, oh, that's a really pretty profound thing to put in a children's movie. As opposed to, no shade here because I love this man, as opposed to Fred Rogers just saying, Whatever you're feeling is okay. You're a special person, and you have to find that part. You know, like, this is a very sort of all around very, very positive reinforcement, which I think is great.
There's and value in that, for sure.
I love Fred Rogers and the message that he had. But this is a message about, like, sometimes things aren't great, and you have to find what's great and just hang on to that yourself. And let the rest of the world be shitty, if that's what the rest of the world has made up their mind that it's going to do.
Yeah.
And that's a really different, kind of darker message, but also kind of a very realistic message to give to kids.
Can I elaborate on the metaphor a little more? Because
yes.
This movie doesn't get into it, but the rest of the series does.
The book series?
Yes. Because it kind of, there's a point that they reach where Count Olaf gets what he wants, and the children are still alive, and they have this moment. Like, he has the fortune, he has this secret thing that he's been after, and, like, he basically is just like, see you later, and he's gonna go off and try to rule the world. And they kind of, like, have this moment where they're like, we can either accept this and just kind of go live with our friends. Like, they have an escape route. But they instead choose to let their friends escape and go after Count Olaf and try to stop him. So it's kind of like, to expand on the metaphor, like, cut the people you don't, like, that are harming you out of your life. But also, if you see someone in the world who's causing a lot of harm.
Sure.
With messages of bigotry, then that's when you kind of risk your freedom to kind of help other people.
Sure, there's a point of seeing an injustice and right, you know what I mean? It's sort of like, yeah, if you're a homophobe, fine. I'm not going to change your mind. But if I see you, you know, in writing a public place, like, yeah. Vandalizing or you know, like, rolling gay dudes, I'm gonna step up and put an end to it. It just is like,
I would say, in the metaphor of, like, online fights, like, rather than like, oh, you're a commenter calling something gay, like, I'm not gonna lecture you. But if you're like a lawmaker signing into law that, like, gay people can't adopt. Like, that's the big evil that you want.
That kind of, right. The kind of, that's a better, that's more mature example, actually, than me fighting guys in a parking lot.
This is like Batman just avenging people.
The idea of, like, taking action against harmful legislation is actually a really good one. And that will come up later in my shoutouts.
Oh, stay tuned.
I'm backing anti-gay legislation.
Vote Republican this year. What?
But
that's
really interesting.
Another message in this movie and in the books and the story in general is that adults don't listen to children, and it ends up harming everyone.
I think that's a common thing in a lot of children's stories. Like, children's adventure stories is...
Oh, that's true. Like, the unbelievable...
Adults are dumb, you know, and kids... It takes kids to sort everything out. And I think that's totally fine. Like, they kind of handle it here by just, like, killing off the parents right away. And then, like, all the adults who are... Like, the banker guy. And then the cop...
The detective.
Cedric the Entertainer is hilarious as the...
Who woke me up at 9 in the morning for this? Absolutely clueless
cop. But, like, yeah, they're all just, like, bureaucrats who are just like, oh, these children are basically on paper and we just have to move them around one place to another.
Right. There's a law or the will or something. It says that they should stay with their closest living relative. And that's obviously meant to imply that the one that they know the most, but instead it's just like...
Whoever lives the closest to them.
Completely misreading the law there.
That's yeah, that's a funny bit in there. But yeah, I think that's a common kids movie trope, and it really works great here because these kids are so like capable. Like these kids are so smart.
And they're more capable than the adults are.
Right. Right. Like Klaus is a genius and then Violet like invents things. And yeah. I do like that this movie shows you that, but they really just like, it's an exposition dump right at the beginning. Here's Violet. Here's what she does. Here's Klaus. Here's what he does. Here's Sunny. Here's what she does.
She bites things.
And their parents died. Okay, now let's get into the story. There's not like a half hour of setting up.
Or granted, anything. There's no time for any of that in this movie because they gotta keep moving through three different books worth of right. set pieces and
but a lot Guardians. Of people a lot of people don't like that though. A lot of people don't like a movie that opens with like text explaining things. Or anything like that, but I'm just kind of like, that gets you to the starting point. In this movie, I think it works.
It frees you up to do better things.
Yeah, and it helps that there's also, like, Jude Law as the narrator, as Lemony Snicket. He's there, he doesn't just dump that and go away. He's there through the movie. Like,
yeah,
it's a narration that runs the whole movie.
He's kind of an unreliable narrator in this, like... Just kind of like, I don't know exactly what happened here, and like, I'm piecing this together through people's stories and reaccounts. It's kind of interesting how they do that.
Yeah, and right from the beginning when they're doing like the fake elf movie.
Yeah.
You know, and then he pulls the rug out from under that, and he's like, yeah, that's not what this movie is. And then they completely go into something totally different.
Every time I watch this movie, I forget that's a thing. And then I'm like, what the hell? Because it's this little, like, claymation or animation or whatever elf going through the forest. And then it's like, nope, this is not a happy movie.
And then that elf shows up again.
He does.
That's the bobblehead there. And
it's a nice little Easter egg.
Yeah, it's cool. What else you got?
Well, we kind of already touched on this, but, like, knowledge trumping evil, kind of, like, there's this whole thing in the books, and it's here as well, with, like, being knowledgeable and reading books is the key to fighting ignorance. And that's, like, why the kids are, like, these child geniuses, is because they value their education, and they read these books, and they invent things, and
right.
that's kind of what leads them to... defeating evil.
Yeah. You get a sense that there is that's like true knowledge. And then this seems like it was probably a book point or planned for a later movie. Like their parents were part of some secret society kind of thing.
Yeah.
With the spy glasses and things like that. And, you know, whatever that symbolized. And then Count Olaf, who has the... He has the eye tattoo and the eye window. And I feel like that's some sort of like metaphor for like knowledge, like seeing into like deeper, like the eye of knowledge or something like that.
Can I explain that? Because you're right. Oh, you're like right on the money there.
But he probably perverted that in some way. And that's why it's like that's the Dark, the Sith Jedi thing, you know, one took the shortcut and perverted, you know, what knowledge should be, and in the light side, the knowledge is pure, and that's why it wins.
You're out. Like so right about that. There's an organization called VFD, which is a mystery for a long part of the book. It's short for
Violins for Dogs.
Close.
Oh man, I was on a roll.
The Volunteer Fire Department.
Okay.
and it's this just group of literary geniuses, and basically there's a split in the group, and they all have the eye tattoo. That is something that they all have. But Count Olaf, he's the only one it's noticed in the beginning. So they think it's like this evil symbol, but it's really not.
Okay.
Because he leads this schism in the group, because they find this, it's really just, what's it called, when it's an item and it doesn't really matter what it is.
Oh, like a MacGuffin.
It's a MacGuffin, yeah. Okay. It's this, teacup, and it's like, what's inside the teacup? And it doesn't matter, because they're just arguing over it, and that argument leads to a perversion of what the truth is.
Okay.
So, yeah, it's this whole kind of thing. And so Count Olaf is just trying to take the shortcut. He's trying to basically rule the world without understanding what the world is.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
Because, what's her name? Meryl Streep. I don't remember her character.
Aunt Josephine.
That's it. Her dead husband had that picture of the same window with the eye in it.
Right. I think that was kind of like an investigation into Count Olaf.
Okay.
And that's why he died.
I don't know if it was his invention that like Olaf stole it, because then like all the fires started. Either way, like it's cool. I would have thought it was, that picture that she didn't want them to see. Like, is Olaf supposed to be in that photograph?
Yeah, that's okay. That's like their club. Lemony Snicket was also in the club.
Okay.
So, like, all of the guardians in this series, like, all of the adults, they were part of this club, and then it broke up, and that's why they're all kind of damaged. That's why Dr. Montgomery, he lost his wife and his family. Aunt Josephine, she lost her husband, and that's why she's so terrified of everything.
Right. Even though she lives in the most dangerous house in the world.
But she's terrified of realtors.
I love her, like, overly cautious about I only serve cold food. And mm-hmm. You don't want to get burned. But her house is, like, literally hanging off of a cliff.
And then all of her things come true at... That's during right. The hurricane scene.
The fridge falls. yeah. Yeah, that was all very clever. I want to talk about Jim Carrey just a little bit.
Do it.
Because I don't think Jim Carrey was at a point where he had to do this movie. He was a big star. He had been doing more dramatic things and more... kind of interesting things. He did, I think around this time, he did that movie, The Number 27, which nobody liked, but it was just such a weird, like, he was just really into starting to do, like, really weird kind of...
This is around this, Truman Show was around this time, right?
What year was this movie?
2004.
Truman Show was actually 98?
Oh.
98, 99? Okay. But the Truman Show kind of kicked off his dramatic... stuff. Man on the Moon, Truman Show, all around that time where he started doing like less Ace Ventura stuff.
I mean, that was really a dramatic, riveting movie, but yes.
Truly. But I think this is a really interesting role for Jim Carrey because he's doing comedy, but it's not Ace Ventura talking with his ass. It's a lot of makeup. It's a lot of weird character work. And I think it is a complex acting role because he is being Count Olaf and doing a great portrayal of this character. And then when Count Olaf is in disguise, like we talked about earlier, he's portraying him being a terrible actor and a terrible liar. And it's just... I think everything and all the jokes he's making and all the weird faces and he's like so expressive with his body. Like when he's in that chair, like...
He's like, who should play the count?
Who should play the most handsome man?
Yeah.
You know, like... And he's like really like posing and he's just so physical with everything he does.
I
really think it's this performance... of Jim Carrey's that nobody ever talks about, but it really is like, whatever you think of this movie, I think Jim Carrey is really like compelling in it.
One of my favorite things is when the train is about to flatten the kids and he's in this store, like watching the cups shake and he's laughing maniacally and drinking a Slurpee super yeah. slowly.
And then he doesn't hear the crash and he's like, what? Yeah.
There's even like his laugh turns into a huh?
Yeah.
At the end. Like, it's so
He is good. Like a cartoon character, but there's more depth to it. There's just something about it that I'm like...
Villainy is cartoonish.
Yes.
He's greed personified.
Right. And he does that and still manages to sort of make it three-dimensional. You know what I mean? He's mm-hmm. not a super complex character at all. But I don't know. I feel like Jim Carrey has a lot going on in playing this character. And I did see a little bit of the Neil Patrick Harris thing too. And I think he did it really well too. But he played it more like...
A little more straight evil.
A little more like a Bond villain. Like, clearly evil, but he's not really stretching himself to go over the top. And Jim Carrey does go over the top, but also just...
He knows how to do it.
He knows exactly how far to take it. And, mm-hmm. you know, even when he's like, the baby is like at his feet looking up and whatever gibberish. And he's like, hey, babe, hey! You know, like he's doing it back to her. It's just like so ridiculous. And then the thing that really got me is when they look up the stairs and they're like, what's up there? And he's like, you must never go up there. And then he turns around and he's like trying not to laugh out loud. It's just, it's the most Jim Carrey expressive range on his face. And I don't know, there's something about this where I'm really like, because this movie, I have some problems with parts of it. It's not like great, but I think every scene he's in, he's just hitting it perfectly. Like, note perfect.
Yeah.
For every thing he delivers, it goes just over the top enough. It's not annoying. Like, Jim Carrey can be too much sometimes, but it's like he knows exactly where to stop it and everything lands perfectly.
When he's convincing the judge to be an actress so that he'll yeah. actually marry Violet.
Right.
Like, that's like a perfect scene.
Yeah. And I totally forgot she was in this movie. Catherine O'Hara.
Yeah.
Your girl from Schitt's Creek.
That's right.
Yeah.
I thought, I can never remember her name. Jessie from Toy Story.
Oh, Joan Cusack.
Yeah, Joan yeah. Cusack. She plays the judge in the TV show. And so I thought she was in this and I was all okay. confused. I was like, wait, no, that's the wrong actor.
Right.
Yeah,
I can see that.
You said you had some issues with this.
What? This movie just gets a little bit slow in the middle. It feels like it drags a little bit through a lot of like the Aunt Josephine stuff. I think that segment plays out a little bit long.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's kind of like the third time we're seeing the same plot play
right.
out.
Right. And and then sort of the lead up to the play after that, which is, it's short, but there's something about it. Just like, okay, let's get.
It's like we don't know where the climax is coming.
Right. By the time we get to the play opening, I feel like it's like, all right, let's move this along to get to where it needs to be. And then the part where Klaus is like, you know, climbing up the. That's paced weird in the cuts back and forth between him fighting the hook hand guy and the stuff that, you know, Violet very slowly signing her name. You know what I mean?
Like, yeah.
It's just a weird cut back and forth. It's not terrible. I don't think this movie's bad by any stretch of the imagination. I think this is a really solid movie. And by kids' movie standards, I think it's great. Because it's not afraid to play dark. But it just, there's a couple parts where I think it's just pacing issues is the only, I'm not the book bros who are like, oh, it's not, it doesn't have this, it doesn't have
no,
this.
No, I agree with pacing issues.
But
this movie, it's what you get when you cram three books
right.
into one. And like, I don't know, but I much prefer that to if they had tried to do 13 movies.
13 movies, right.
Which would be, like, impossible.
I think it's why I like the Uncle Montgomery segment better than the Aunt Josephine one. Because that's the first good guy that they go stay with. But it's the second time they're settling into a new place. So it's
like that.
It's the moving to a new place gets worn out by the third time. And the fact that it's another good guy who gets wiped out, it all is just played out by the end of the Meryl Streep part for me.
Yeah, well, you can really, like, see them do the setup and ending. Like, they kind of just rushed it, which is way better than if it had been, like, another 10 minutes of Aunt Josephine, which... Right. In the books, like, if they had correctly adapted it like people really wanted, like, it would have been. So I'm glad they just kind of, like, quickly introduce her, quickly introduce that she's terrified, introduce Curdled Cave, and then boom, instant suicide. Like, right. Just get it over
it's
with.
It's a really strange segment. Because even, like, the Marketplace thing where Jim Carrey's playing, like, the sea captain.
Yeah.
Like, that goes on for a long time. It's like, holy crap, this just, it just keeps going.
I kind of just think Jim Carrey had fun with playing him.
I do wonder, like, how much of what ended up on screen was just Jim Carrey, like, improvising.
I actually had the thought, him and Meryl Streep, like, played off each other so well. And those are two actors that are in, like, totally different parts of my brain. But, like, when they're, like, when he's trying to seduce her and, like, their lips almost touch and it's just, like, this ridiculous thing.
Yeah.
It's really fun.
Yeah, it is fun. And it's fun to see an actor of Meryl Streep's caliber, you know, having fun playing a kind of cartoon character in a kid's movie. Like, I think that's really cool when, I mean, she's one of the most respected actresses in the world. And, you know, it's like, oh, hey, come be in this weird Nickelodeon Studios kids movie.
I wonder, like, what kind of deal with the devil you have to sign to, like, even get her to look at your movie pitch. Like,
I wonder if it's one of those things where I was on Hit Me One More Time a couple weeks ago, and we were talking about Batman Returns or Batman Forever. Yeah.
It was Batman Forever.
And, like, how bad Tommy Lee Jones is in that movie. And reportedly, he did that. He didn't want to do that movie. Also a Jim Carrey movie. He didn't want to do that movie, but his kids wanted him to do it. So, like, he did that movie for his kids. And the same Frank Langella, we talked about it then. Frank Langella did the He-Man, the Masters of the Universe movie. He played Skeletor because his kids wanted him to do it. Mm-hmm. And that ended up being, like, his most favorite role he ever played because he just got to cut loose. But it's like, I wonder if, like, Meryl Streep had kids or grandkids that were like, hey, you should do this movie. I love these books or
whatever. These books were big at the time.
Yeah.
So it does make sense.
We haven't even talked about the fact that Dustin Hoffman is in this movie.
Who does he play?
Dustin Hoffman has, like, a cameo. He comes to see
the
play.
He's in the audience.
Yeah. He shows up, he has two lines, and it's just like, I kept waiting for them to acknowledge it, like, Dustin Hoffman. I'm like, well, he's got to do something. It's Dustin Hoffman. Nope, that's it. It's like his weirdest cameo.
He's, like, just sitting with the detective.
Yeah. And he makes, like, weird offhand comments through the play. It's so strange.
It's really interesting. I wonder if that was them trying to set up the next movie, because in book 4 there's a character who, like, I kind of feel like that, like, he would fit, like, he's this like businessman lumberjack owner. Like, I wonder if that's what they were trying to do.
Weird. Yeah, that could have been.
They already have their celebrity stars set up.
They got them lined up. Yeah.
I don't know. One interesting trivia bit that I have, and book fans hate the movie for this. Klaus is supposed to wear glasses. And the reason they didn't do this is because Harry Potter was coming out at this time.
Mm-hmm.
And they thought that if they had a nerd with glasses saving the day, it would be like too similar.
Harry Potter really ruined glasses branding.
Real. So they went without the glasses, and people were very irrationally upset about
that. This must have been that same Simpsons season where Milhouse didn't have glasses. He had contacts.
Is that a whole season?
No, I'm just joking. But that's really interesting, because Klaus does have glasses at the very beginning of the movie.
Right.
When they introduce him, he has like a fancy little steampunk glasses case that he takes his reading glasses out with.
But they just don't use it the most.
He's never seen in wearing glasses. That's really interesting, because I remember going into bookstores around this time, and every young adult fantasy series looked like Harry Potter. They were deliberately copying, you know, the style. And it was always like a kid who kind of looked like Harry Potter in the same fonts and everything. And it's really interesting that this was a franchise that said, no, we are deliberately not going to.
We're steering away from that.
And I have seen the book covers. They look totally different as well. And it just to be conscious of, like, Harry Potter wears glasses, we're not going to get mixed up with that English twit.
No way.
And we're going the other way. Contacts for Klaus.
That's right.
That is interesting.
It's just an interesting, directorial decision.
Yeah.
I don't know. Not sure what else to say about this.
I liked the end credits.
Oh, yeah.
End credit animation looks great.
I love when it's not just, like, rolling.
Yeah. They give you something to look at.
Yeah.
They give you something to stick around for, to read the names and be entertained with good visuals.
Mm-hmm. And there's good music in this movie, too. Sometimes I just, like, listen to the soundtrack, because it sounds like the book series for me.
It sounds like the book series?
Yeah, it's tied to
Turning Pages?
No.
Who did the score, do you know?
The music is by Thomas Newman.
Thomas Newman. I feel like I know that name.
Let's see. He did WALL-E. He did 007. Or Skyfall, sorry.
Ooh.
1917. The Help. Striptease. I don't know. There's a bunch of these. The Newsroom. Oh, that's a TV show, isn't it?
Yeah, HBO. Yep.
Yeah, he's done a lot of stuff.
Yeah. Oh. You had me at WALL-E. That's all I got for this one. This is a fun movie. And if you are a hater on this because of the book series, I really recommend you try to separate that and go back and give this another shot. I think this movie is a lot more fun than it gets credit for. I had seen this when you guys were kids.
Okay.
But I didn't remember all of it. Like, I didn't quite... I remember, like, the high points of it.
Has your opinions changed at all?
No, I thought it was a fine movie then. I wasn't, like, over the moon about it. And I don't think that... Like I said, I'm not, like, over the moon about this movie, but it's fun. It's a fun movie. I enjoyed it. I enjoyed watching this. And I think if your negative opinion was colored mostly just from an... adapted movie point of view, where it's like, this isn't exactly like the book, so therefore I don't like it. I think giving it another look is worth a shot, because this movie's better than it. I hear a lot of hate for this movie, and I can't get my head around, like, this movie's fine. This movie's a good time.
A lot of that resurfaced after the series came out. But, like, the series, like, season two of that dragged so much for me, because it's just, it, like, really hits that it's repetitive.
Right.
And they kind of, like, didn't follow, like, a TV show format. Like, this is an adaption in the way that it changes to fit the format.
Right.
And, like, if you don't like that,
yeah.
If you don't like that, that's fine. Just read the books. But If you want a movie version, here you go.
No, no, you've ruined my childhood.
All right. Also, they added in that, like, letter thing.
At the very end?
The parents'
with
letter.
The spyglass. Yeah.
And that scene is so beautiful to me.
It's really cool. It's a nice ending. I thought it would be cheesy. And I'm like, oh, no, that was actually really nice.
Yeah. And I would actually, the reason I picked this is because I think it's a better introduction. Like, I would recommend this before I recommend the books or the series. Just because it's
interesting.
It's a shorter time investment, and it really gives you the picture of what you're signing up for.
You're taking the J.F. DeBoe technique.
Is that his thing?
J.F. told me once that he always sees the movie first, and then when you read the book, it's like expanded universe. It's the story plus all the extra stuff that didn't make the cut for the movie. So
right.
It's actually like bonus content that way, which I had never thought of that. And I'm like, oh, that's really wild. So
that is kind of genius.
After I watch Dune this year, then I'll have 9 trillion pages of bonus content.
With Dune, actually, I am planning on reading that before I see it, because I want to visualize the characters my own way.
Better get started.
I'll just be a little late on the movie.
Come on. I might be able to see that one in theaters by then.
Well, you can take Mom or something.
Come on, man. We got to do it for the show. We got to be timely.
Patreon reward. Go see Dune with my dad.
Let me take your mom to see Dune. She won't hate me forever for that. Is this the one with Sting? No, that's the old one.
The better one.
Ooh.
I have no idea. I've never seen it.
Very much. New Dune looks cool. I can't wait.
It does.
Yeah. Sandworms, baby.
Timothée Chalamet.
And what's that?
Zendaya?
Yeah, Zendaya. Yeah. Mary Jane, right?
It's a hot cast, yep.
It is. Jason Momoa. Jason Momoa looks great in it. I like Jason Momoa.
I can't deny that, yeah.
I think he's a funny guy. I see him on TikTok and
He's got charisma.
He does. He's a likable dude. And I saw him on Instagram. He had this video and he had this old Telecaster bass, and he's like, people ask me why I started playing bass, and he points back in the corner and there's like drum setup. He goes, my kids played drums and I wanted to play rhythm with them. And he learned how to play bass so he could hang out with his kids and
that's
play
incredible
music. I'm like, that's awesome, man. So yeah, I think he's super cool, and I think he's gonna be great in Dune.
All right,
anyway, let's move on to shoutouts.
All right. I'm shouting out something a little weird. It's a phone app. I believe it's on iPhone 2, but it's definitely on Android. And it's on the Google Play Store. Okay. It's called Like a Dino. And this is indie. This is all done by one person.
Cool.
And I read their bio. They're also working on a short film. Like, they've got like an animated short film that they're working on with concept art. Really cool. But like this game, it's simple enough gameplay. You're a dinosaur and there's things moving at you and it makes your head grow, but it's like to the beat of a song, and there's like over 20 songs that you get to unlock, and they're all like composed by this person, and the art is done by this person.
Oh, wow.
And it's really cool how much is there. And there's even like this love story between like the dino you're playing has like a lover that he's trying to get to. It's kind of weird, but it's a cute game, and it's also got like positivity to it. Like, when you lose, it's like, it's okay to not be okay, and it gives you like little
here come the participation trophies. You know what? There were no participation trophies for real dinosaurs. That's why they're extinct.
Or there were too many participation
trophies.
You think
so? It made them soft?
Yeah.
Yeah.
They would have fought off that meteor.
They would have fought off the meteor. Yeah.
So, yeah, I wanted to give that a shout out.
That sounds cool. Indie games rock, man. Like,
yeah.
I love when, like, small teams or, you know, one person or whatever is, you know, putting it all together. That's mm-hmm. that's really
And this
badass.
Is really smooth. Like, it looks nice for a small production.
I'm going to check that out.
What do you have?
I have a podcast that I want to shout out called Call Kevin. This is Kevin James Thornton. I think you can get it on his website, kevinjamesthornton.com. I found this guy on TikTok, and he is a bearded gay gentleman who talks into an auto-tuner and tells embarrassing stories about him being raised in a fundamentalist Christian church and his time in as a theater student, his time, you know, making art and trip. And he just tells these stories and they're really funny. And he's just a really charming, charismatic guy. And he started a podcast, and it's a call-in podcast where people can call, ask a question, and he answers it on the show. He just plays these messages.
I've seen his TikToks. I've not seen the podcast.
The podcast is really, he's a really interesting guy. And he, some of it is just like, you know, asking about his background and asking about where he comes from and this and that. And some of it is a lot of like LGBT issues. A lot of, gay people call in, with questions. You know, some people are like newly out of the closet and, just different issues that come up and that, you know, he's, if you're going to ask somebody, ask this, theater kid, gay dude, but like, and he's talked about, and I kind of teased this earlier, talked about people who are like, I'm an ally, but I'm also a Republican. And it's like, he kind of has brought up, can you be an ally if you are voting for people who will put policies in place that are restrictive to LGBT people? You know, and things like that. And it's not all that heavy. Some of it is a lot lighter. He generally has a really positive outlook. He's fun to listen to. So even when he's talking about something serious like that, he's bringing his own perspective and his own experience with it, and kind of doing it without bringing the room down.
That's cool.
But
that's,
it's not all like hilariously funny. He's just a really charming guy, and
it's a good perspective to have.
And the show's usually about a 30-minute call-in show, and I really recommend you check it out. And if you're on TikTok, find him on TikTok. It is, you will lose an afternoon just listening to hilarious stories about the time he rewrote Rocky Horror Picture Show, but cast Bible characters in it so he could sell it to his pastor as a church play.
No idea how that works.
He's a really hilarious guy, and the podcast is really cool.
All right. What was that again?
It's called Call Kevin.
Kevin. It's a pretty gay name.
Oh, he's a pretty gay guy. On that note, we want to thank you for listening to this episode of The Picture Show with Austin and Phil Rude. If you enjoy our show, please leave a review on your podcatcher of choice. It helps our visibility, and it helps us grow the show.
Another way to help us grow is to tell a friend, or if they'll listen to you. I know a lot of adults do not listen to children. And that is maybe our main demographic. Probably not. But,
I would hope not.
Whatever.
By the way, kids, check out our 2-hour True Romance.
That's
extravaganza from last week.
Anyway, our podcast is scientifically proven to be the best one.
Our scientist is also scientifically proven to be the best one. Isn't that right, scientist?
Anyway, what's our next movie?
Our next movie will be our last movie review of the season.
Better be a good one.
It is a good one. We're going to watch Kubo and the Two Strings.
All right.
Leica Studios animated picture about a Japanese kid who does magical origami and plays a weird Japanese guitar. Anyway, it's a super cool animated movie. And we are going to review it. New to you, right?
Yeah, I missed it when it was coming out. It just kind of slipped through the cracks. But it was one that, like, intrigued me.
Yeah.
So I'm a little disappointed I didn't see it.
I'm really looking forward to it. I thought we'd end it we started with an animated
movie
that you love, and we're going to end it out on an animated movie that I love, both about music as well.
Look at that.
How about that? Bookends, baby. That's how it works.
We totally planned this podcast out.
You would think so. But yeah, we're going to do that, and then we're going to do a wrap-up episode recapping season 2. Right. And then we're going to be on hiatus until probably end of summer. But yeah, we're going to bring it back. We're over 40 episodes now. Can you believe that?
That's pretty awesome.
That is pretty awesome.
It's a lot of movie watching.
Yep, it is. Austin, social media, throw it out there.
I know it this week. I am Austin N. Rude on Twitter, and I'm also Old Who Review on Twitter. Anywhere else, I exist, but do not interact, so Twitter's your best bet to find me.
Fair enough. I am at philrude.com, and you can get my social media handles from there. You can check out artwork that I've got for sale. You can see a post for all of our episodes. And in this last week, I have put a page up that just has all of the videos, all of our episodes on video. So if you want to watch them and you don't want to surf YouTube for it, go to philrude.com and it's got a video page. And all cool. of our episodes are there. Austin, you want to read the credits?
Yep. We do everything ourselves.
Well, there you have it. I'll see you next time on The Picture Show.
See ya.
Have you even seen the Flintstones?
Is that the joke? Is that why...
Dino is like their dog.
But it's a dinosaur.
It's a dinosaur. That's how it's spelled. It's like dino, but it's Dino.
That's dumb. I didn't know that.
How dare you?
Hi, this is Mouse.
I'm Weens.
We have the Mouse and Weens podcast. I'm the mom that lives in suburbia with 3 kids.
I'm alone.
She's the hot Hollywood
cat lady.
And we have a fun podcast where we talk about life, love, and...
loneliness.
Pubic hair, come on.
I'm sorry.
We hope you come take a listen to us. We're on all the platforms, and we will see you soon.
I have PMS.
Hey, this is Kate. I'm a forensic psychologist and crisis clinician, and I collect stories. Everything from true crime to trauma to parenthood. There's a lot more in common between depression and sociopathy, or between serial killers and podcasters, than you might think. Are you sure you really want to know? This is Ignorance Was Bliss at iwbpodcast.com and iwbpodcast on social media.